Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you listening in today as we talk about heirloom seeds with our guest, Jer Gettle. He's the founder of Baker Creek Heirloom Seeds, and they're celebrating their 23rd annual seed catalog this year. It is a beautiful book, chock full of great information about varieties from around the world. So we'll talk with him about heirlooms, his business. And Jer Gettle, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Really appreciate being on the air with you. It's always great to be here.
It's fun talking with you. First, just to get our definitions in order here, what is the definition of an heirloom seed in your mind?
An heirloom seed is kind of the same as like an antique or heritage seed. They have different terms in different countries, but they're seeds that are passed down generation to generation through families. Oftentimes, you know, hundreds of years old, sometimes thousands of years old, but it's a seed that's open pollinated, which means it's not an F1 hybrid that's a variety that's not patented either or controlled in any way. So it's a variety that you can save and pass on to your children.
And I mentioned earlier that this is your 23rd seed catalog, and it seems even bigger than it was last year. Talk about what people can find in it. I find it absolutely fascinating to look through it, and the photography is unbelievable.
Yeah, what we specialize in is finding traditional varieties and bringing them back to commerce. You know, there might be a variety of squash that was really popular in the catalogs in the 1800s. And our job is to research those varieties, try to find if they're still out there and bring them back. And every year we bring back several new traditional historic varieties that are, you know, from America. Plus we find things from China and Japan and all over the world. And people send us stuff from many different countries. And we trial it and pick out the best, what we figure is the best and what we feel is the best, whether it's a traditional variety that we find in historic American catalogs or varieties that might come from across the globe.
How important is this catalog to your business?
Well, internet is becoming more and more, you know, crucial to a business, but a catalog is still, you know, fundamental to a lot of the seed industry anyway. Not all seed companies still have catalogs, but many of us still like that paper catalog. You know, in all the different industries, the seed catalog is one that's kind of sticking around, I think, more than others, because it kind of brings back memories of, you know, reading the seed catalog with mom or grandma or aunt or uncle or whoever it was, brings back those memories. You can also sit there and, you know, dream about spring. I think it gets people in the mood for spring. So I think that's why seed catalogs keep going.
Well, it's an amazing catalog, and I absolutely love going through it. And there's a cost connected with it.
We actually have two. We have the free catalog, which is about 148 pages. And then we have the big whole seed catalog, which this year is, I think we added another 100 pages. It's about 450 pages, the big whole seed.
Yeah, it sells for $10, something like that.
It's like $12 or something like that. But anyway, the $10 or $12, depending on where you get it. But it's more than just a catalog. We try to add lots of articles and stories and histories and recipes and lots of just fun facts and notes. Try to tell the story of heirloom vegetables in a kind of a cross between a catalog and a magazine and a book.
So. Yeah, it really makes for interesting reading, and then just looking at the photos is absolutely amazing to me. And we've got callers online, but before we get to Rich and Two Rivers, just a question about heirloom seeds. Has the world of heirloom seeds changed much? You know, you started when you were 17 with your first catalog.
Yeah, it's definitely, definitely is changing continuously.
Yeah, and in what ways that are maybe you never expected or maybe?
There's definitely been a lot of ups and downs. To start out with, we started in 1998. It was really slow. The next year was 1999, right before the year Y2K, and everybody was, you know, nervous about that for one reason or another. So it grew our business. We went from like, you know, just a few, like maybe 100 orders, a couple hundred orders, something like that, a few hundred orders anyway, to thousands of orders. And then in the recession, you know, back in 2008 and 2009, the business grew about 100% each of those 2 years. And then with this coronavirus thing going on, again, you know, just like, you know, toilet paper and a lot of commodity things, seeds are seen as one of those things. Oh, boy, we better have a vegetable garden. So we're actually, if anything, too busy right now, unfortunately. Fortunately or unfortunately, we have more going on than what we. And so that's what the biggest surprise. You just never know how it's going to change. It can go from, you know, be getting a certain amount of orders one day to triple that amount the next week. You just never know. So it's a total, it's ups and downs, and any kind of emergency situation makes the seed business go crazy. So you always have to be ready for the ride.
Rich in Two Rivers has a question for you. So let's go there. Rich, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yeah. Good morning, gentlemen. Yeah, I have actually two questions. My first question is, a couple of years back, I planted morning glories, and I got the seeds from one of the local department stores, and I grew them in the house, and then I placed them in a sunny morning east side off the side of my shed, and they grew to be about 6 feet tall, and then they never flowered at all. And the other thing I want to know is, how can I get your catalog? And how fast can I get it? And I can take the answer off the air.
All right. Thank
sure.
you.
That sounds good. The morning glories, why they didn't flower, that's strange. Morning glories usually flower really easily. But sometimes this is a variety that's been selected in the far south somewhere, and you take them up north. We've actually had a couple varieties even here in Missouri. If they're a southern variety or developed in an area where for some reason they just don't like our climate here and they just almost refuse to flower. And I don't know what the reason is for that. I would say try a different variety and you should have luck, or try a couple different varieties, because normally 98% of the time morning glories flower easily. And as far as the catalog, you can get it on our website. We're almost out right now. It's rareseeds.com. But you can also still get our bigger catalog at like Barnes & Noble and Whole Foods and various grocery and bookstores.
And so just for Rich and everybody else, the catalog title is The Whole Seed Catalog 2020. So there you go. Seeds and stories from across the globe. It's really a fun read. Rich, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. I want to go back. You talked about this last year when you were on the show, but I think your own story is so fascinating. You got started in the vegetable garden at 3.
Correct. Yeah, I started out in the Boise Valley, actually right on the Oregon side of the border from Idaho. I was born in Napa, Idaho, near Boise. But anyway, my parents and my grandparents and all my aunts and uncles gardened, and you know, all the neighbors pretty much all garden. So I was around gardeners all the time. And I pretty much grew up when I was small in the garden for the first, you know, years of my life. And it just took. And, you know, from there, I started, you know, my favorite thing to do was look through seed catalogs and look through the stories and dream someday about, you know, working at a seed company as a small child. And it's just always been part of my dream to work with seeds.
Yeah. And then at 17, you put together your own catalog. How did that come together?
Well, I had been saving seeds and trading seeds and a member of different seed saving groups like Seed Savers Exchange and so forth. And I thought I might as well print a little price list, see how it goes. So in 1998, I sent out the first little price list. It was just a Xeroxed, thing that I put up on the computer with about 75 varieties. And it was just, I didn't know whether it would take off or not, but it's fortunately, it's gotten busier every year.
Marcus in Oregon has a question, I believe, or a comment. Marcus, hello.
Hey, I just wanted to put in a plug for Seed Savers in Decorah. If you're ever next to Decorah, you got to stop by their property. They just have a wonderful garden that you can go cruise through. They have hiking trails, and they're just doing a wonderful job as an organization promoting heirloom seeds, and I've been telling everyone I know about it. And the property is just gorgeous. It's also just a great place to go consume cannabis.
There you go. Well, Marcus, you could also visit, I believe, Jer's place, too, in Missouri.
It is. Yeah. Unfortunately, this year we have canceled our festivals as of today due to the, you know, potential coronavirus risk and large tour groups. But we still have the place open for people to come visit the gardens and the store at this point. But Seed Savers is an amazing. I've been up there several times. It's been, I think, 10 years now, but I want to get up again. I loved taking the walking trails. It's really a beautiful, it feels like you're in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, and your own people are going to be able to see quite a bit at your place, too, if they stop by.
Correct. We'll have the gardens open. Actually, we have the indoor gardens. The greenhouse is open right now for people if they want to walk through. But anyway, Seed Savers has a – if you're in that area, Seed Savers is an amazing amazing stop for hiking, too. Not just their gardens, but their nature, the wildlife, and the wildflowers are amazing there.
Marcus, thanks again. Appreciate it. Let's turn to Kel in Sugar Camp next. Hi, Kel.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering if you knew anything about this perennial corn that was discovered in Mexico. I believe the University of Wisconsin has some seeds and they're working on it. But it grows very tall, and it's kind of a mythical plant. It's very old. I was wondering if you knew anything about it or if you were able to get seeds from it.
Unfortunately, we don't have seeds yet. I've heard of it, but that's all. I don't know a whole lot about it other than I've heard it mentioned, but I don't actually have seeds. Unfortunately, most of the corns we have tried from Mexico haven't done well up here. They haven't wanted to set ears very easily. That's been our biggest challenge with the typical corns we've got from at least southern Mexico has been a challenge.
Yeah, the seeds, you know, just don't do as well. Sometimes I had some work in Trinidad several years back, and I was there for a year, and the corn there always did not taste well to me. So when I came back, I got some seed from here and took it down there. And then later I heard from the guy that they just didn't turn out well. And I, you know, it's sort of a question of the environment that they're raised in and the soil and everything else. I thought they'd do well, but they didn't. Darn.
Yeah, it's always something to learn with gardening, that's for sure.
Yeah, we got that right. Jared Gettle, our guest today, he's been growing things since he was 3 years old, and he has the first did it when he was 17 years old, the Baker Creek Heirloom Seed Catalog. And now they have over around 2,000 varieties of vegetables, flowers, and herbs. It's the largest selection of heirloom varieties in the U.S. Tyler Ditter, our engineer today, Jill Nadeau, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at heirloom seeds today, heirloom plants with our guest, Jared Gettle. He's been in the business of growing vegetables for a long, long time. He's got a great catalog and a great company. You can go online to rareseeds.com, and take a look at, you get some information about the operation and the catalogs and so forth. Speaking of emails, Sally from Lancaster emailed that she ordered a bunch of seeds from your catalog after the interview you and I did last year. And she says, Brad's Atomic Grape Tomatoes are fabulous.
All right. Good to hear that. Yeah, we love them ourselves here at the place. They're always one of our favorite.
And I just opened up to that part of the catalog that has them, page 332, Brad's Atomic Grape Tomato. And that's probably, is it your favorite tomato?
I have several favorites. It's one of my favorites. It depends on what we're doing with it, but it's definitely one of my favorites. For a mid-sized kind of a sauce or fresh eating tomato, it's probably my favorite. My all-time favorite tomato, I like the really tiny ones. I think Lucky Tiger is my all-time favorite tomato, which is more of a, it's not quite so big. The Atomic Grape is more like plum-sized, and the Lucky Tiger is more cherry-sized. So they're about half the size. So it's perfect for snacking is Lucky Tiger. And then Atomic Grape is the other one that I grow every year. And then, of course, I have to have a really big one, which I think The Green Giant, I think, is my favorite really large tomato.
And just as I'm looking here at the Atomic Grape tomato, they're beautiful colors. They're not a traditional sort of red color, but there's purples and yellows, reds kind of mixed in.
And the colors vary a little bit, too, depending on the sunlight. If you have a lot of sunlight and a harsh, bright sun, you get more purples. If you have less, you get more of the other colors. And each plant will vary. So that's the fun thing with them, you know, all and no two plants and no two fruit will be exactly alike.
Yeah, they're beautiful. And Eric in Reedsburg has a question for you.
Hi. Yeah, I do. My question is, what makes it an heirloom? Is there a classification? This is obviously a non-gardener calling, just a consumer.
Okay.
I'll take my call off the air. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Eric.
Yeah, thanks a lot. An heirloom is basically a loose term, so it doesn't have a set date. Some garden groups and gardeners put like 50 years on it. But it's a variety that's been passed down in a family like a piece of furniture. So, you know, in some families, that might be two or three generations. Other families, they might not think of it an heirloom until it's more generations than that. But in general, it's a variety that's been around for a long time and that's not patented or hybridized. It's a traditional variety where you can save your own seed. It will breed true each generation and be able to be passed down. But it's kind of a loose term. It doesn't have like an official use like the word organic, which has like a government sponsored list of qualifications, where the word heirloom doesn't have any qualifications other than it just what the dictionary says, which is basically, you know, something that's been passed down through the generations. You know, an antique or an heirloom is similar.
Very cool. Thanks, Eric. Casey in Algoma, let's turn to you now. Hi, Casey.
Hi, how's it going this morning?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Okay, I'm curious about saving beet seed, but I'm wondering if there's an effective way in my area, hardiness zone 5B, to do it in ground over winter, or is always the best option going to be to remove them, refrigerate them, and replant them the second year?
Yeah, overwintering is, and that was whether you should overwinter them or put them in refrigeration, correct?
Right.
You can do it either way, but if it gets too cold where you're at, it just depends. You know, sometimes, depending on your weather and the winter, some root crops will freeze out over the winter. So it's probably a good idea if you want to save seed, or if you want to save them for eating the following spring, it's a good idea to at least bring some of them inside. Or just give it a test. It's going to be hard to know, though. If you do leave them out, probably mulching them well and then taking the mulch off once the snow melts and it starts warming. So otherwise they might get smothered. But, you know, mulching would probably be necessary if you're going to leave them outside. It's the main thing. If the ground freezes solid, you'll also lose the roots. So I guess that would be the question in your area. If the ground is freezing solid, even with mulch, then you would want to, you know, bring them inside.
Does that help, Casey?
No, that's perfect. That's exactly what I needed. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thanks very much for calling. Steve from Boulder Junction, Wisconsin, called to ask if you are contributing to the World Seed Bank.
We're not actually have contributed ourselves. We've contributed to several seed banks, but we haven't contributed to the one in Norway. We don't have anything against it. I think it's a great, you know, project. Although, you know, my personal opinion, I think it's more keyed to potentially it's going to be in a national disaster, international disaster. It's going to be hard for any of the average 99% of their people to get up there. You know, it's kind of overall, we feel more important. Not to put that one down in any way. I think it's an amazing project. I think it's more important that we keep the seeds alive in local seed banks and local farmers and local gardeners' hands. On the other hand, I mean, we don't have anything against it. And if we were asked, we'd be, you know, glad to ship some seeds there. But it's not, I guess it's not our first priority. We're more working to, you know, get seeds into orphanages and keep seeds live and growing in people's hands versus in a seed bank. But on the other hand, we do appreciate the work seed banks are doing. There needs to be more of both going on.
Marilyn emailed to ask if any of your heirloom varieties handle the wetter, warmer weather better or worse than other varieties.
If you look for varieties, if you're in an area where you have a hot summers, which most hot, humid summers, which mostly central part of the U.S. does, from, you know, southern Minnesota and southern Wisconsin all the way down south, you know, we tend to have hot, humid weather throughout the Midwest and the South in the summer, and that causes disease. So look for varieties that come from warmer climates. If you're having issues, look for varieties that come from places in Asia, places in, you know, if you're in wherever you're located, look for something that comes from a more hot southern location than where you're at if you're having a warm, hot, wet summers. So varieties from Florida often do good where we're located. Varieties from Thailand do well here. And the varieties from China have done amazing overall, because most of China is also hot and humid and wet in the summer.
Roger emailed to say, and this goes back to the morning glory question. He had some morning glories that didn't bloom, and he called this program a couple of years ago. I should have remembered this. He was instructed that morning glories do not like much fertilizer, and he had been using Miracle-Gro or something, and the next year he did not fertilize, and they bloomed.
That's interesting. Yeah, it's, there's so many different things that can go into fruiting and flowering on plants. It's sometimes things that seem foolproof. You know, it can just some little nutrient in your soil might be missing, or something might be a little too heavy, and it can totally disrupt things that normally are just happen on their own.
You find seeds from all around the world. Someone was wondering how do you make sure these plants aren't invasive, for example?
In general, we offer things like fruits and vegetables that are already here. We're just getting different varieties. So a tomato is a tomato. It's the same species, whether it was developed in China or there's one species, basically a tomato, that's growing. So it's not like we're introducing a new species. It's a new variety, a new selection in general. It's common garden fruits and vegetables and flowers and herbs is generally what we sell. So we're not bringing in some new variety we collected in the jungle. It's more like domesticated, you know, common plants that are very unique, but very common as far as the species.
You have a new YouTube channel that features seed stories. Tell us about that.
We do. Yeah. For a number of years, we've wanted a place to basically do some videos and tell the histories and document the histories for the future, not just for now, but oftentimes there's stories about different vegetables that are in danger of just disappearing. So we try to tell the stories, meet the people that might have the varieties, get their photos, sometimes get audio or video recordings of the people that save the varieties. Or just even if we don't have that, we might tell the historical stories, like, you know, what Thomas Jefferson did with the variety or how it was used in ancient cultures, whatever information we have. And then we also do some planting and educational instructional videos on the channel as well.
Yeah, it's pretty cool for sure. As you think about the varieties, are there some new varieties that you've got this year that you're really interested in or maybe excited about?
Oh, yeah, it's always hard to pick, you know, what new variety is the most exciting. It's just you know, there's always so many different ones. One of the most popular ones this year, and one of my favorites, is the Uzbek yellow carrot. It's a very blunt, short carrot. It's kind of shaped like a toe or a thumb. It's very short. It gets a good size to it. It's very sweet and crisp, and everybody just loves it. And so the point of it is, besides it being a beautiful yellow carrot, it grows really well in heavy soil, which most home gardeners don't have, you know, 16 inches of deep loamy soil. So we're trying to focus more and more on some of the varieties that will be, you know, good for that, you know, heavier soils.
So Uzbek.
Uzbek sweetness. And then we have the China Jade cucumber this year, which is out of all our cucumber trials, it won the best tasting cucumber last year. So that was one we're really excited to introduce. And then a whole new host of just a wide variety of things this year. We're just you know, it's just more than we can go, you know, we can go on and on, but it's every year there's so many different things that we find at one place or another and get in the catalog. You know, it's unbelievable amounts of stuff that our customers are able to send to us. Like one thing we're excited about this year is the pink and white dandelions that we have. So think of your yellow dandelions in your yard and turning them all pink or white. And so it's, you know, just it's both fun, and customers are just super excited about, you know, being able just to have the pink dandelion for a novelty. Plus, it's, you know, Also, always dandelion greens are always great to eat as well. So.
There you go. And that China jade cucumber, I'm sure our producer, Jill Nadeau, has written that down. She's the cucumber queen around here, and she loves cucumbers. So I'm expecting to see some cucumbers from her this coming year in the China jade variety. So looking forward to that. Talking about seeds and getting seeds started and so forth, what are the best ways, really, to start seeds indoors?
Well, a lot of seeds can be started indoors, but the best thing to know is not to start too early, especially if you're starting in your house, because they tend to get leggy and overgrown. You also need a bright southern window if you're going to grow them in your house, or you need a grow light or a greenhouse. If you don't have a big enough southern window, you're not going to really do well with starting seeds indoors, unless you have, you know, a grow light, which you can buy those as well on online or at stores. But, you know, the best thing is if you have a bright window or a greenhouse or a grow light, then you can just start pretty much anytime you want. You just have to get bigger and bigger pots to make sure they don't get root bound. The other option is if people don't have pots and don't have indoor growing facilities where they can start some little plants. Some of the earlier varieties of tomatoes and et cetera are pretty easy to start directly in the garden as well. You just lose, you know, 2 or 3 weeks of your growing season is the only problem, but then you get a really nice later summer and fall crop. But, you know, on a lot of things, almost everything you can, the only thing we don't recommend really is eggplants are hard to direct seed. Just simply because they have so many pests that eat the really young plants, it's better to get a start on those. And any of the later varieties would also be difficult if you're in the north. But any of the earlier varieties, like early tomatoes, are you should have early tomatoes starting by seed outdoors in most areas by August anyway.
Joan in Duluth, Minnesota, emailed. She wonders where she can have a seed variety identified. She's grown brown dry beans that have been grown in Minnesota for many years. She believes they came across on the ship that brought her grandfather from Yugoslavia in the early 1900s.
That's interesting.
That's a cool story.
It's really hard to identify the old varieties, especially on beans. There's so many of them that look alike, and we don't really know which one is actually, like, for example, for pinto beans, there's probably 100 different names, probably more than that, 100 different names for very similar looking beans. Whether they're all the same or whether the pinto bean is actually a pinto bean or it should be called something else is oftentimes, you know, the struggle with beans. They tended to be taken everywhere across, especially in America, from so many different places. And like, did that bean, you know, how long, since beans were originally from the Americas, how long was it in Yugoslavia? That type of bean might have been from America originally, ended up in Yugoslavia, or it might have been developed in Yugoslavia or somewhere else in Europe or Asia. So it's really hard to track beans back unless we have some kind of identifying name or, you know, some kind of really unique characteristic. It's really hard on beans to identify them.
Jer Gettle, our guest today, he's been growing things for a long time and has the Baker Creek Heirloom Seed Catalog. You can find out all about his place in Missouri by going to rareseeds.com. That's rareseeds.com. Andy in Eau Claire emailed that he stopped at Baker Creek Seeds in 2012, and while in the store, you came through, and he stopped you for a quick hi and a picture. He thought you'd hurry off, but you stood and talked a bit. He adds he loves the varieties that Baker Creek offers.
Well, tell him hello for us, and we really appreciate him coming to the store here in Missouri. I really really appreciate him stopping in, and we always love having people come by. Just be careful out there if you're traveling around right now. But anyway, we always appreciate people coming. We're just you know, it's just a little bit uncertain times right now. So make sure you check our schedule before anybody makes a long trip down this way. But we always appreciate people stopping in, though.
Yeah. One seed or vegetable that caught Jill's eye was the wasabi radish. And it's amazing taste.
It's a fun one. We found it actually in Japan a couple of years ago or so. And they grow it in Japan for a substitute for the wasabi root. And it tastes, when it's growing in the warmer part of the year, it tastes very much like, you know, very similar to wasabi. If you grow it in the winter, it's like a very mild wasabi. If you grow it in the summer, it's spring or summer, it's very spicy. Has a lot of great flavor, and it's great. You grate it in, it makes anything green too. When you grate it into mayonnaise or whatever you want to put it in, it makes. You can put it in soups or salads or, you know, whatever dish you want to add a little bit of a wasabi horseradishy kick to it. It's great for grating into anything.
And it looks beautiful. You've got a shot of it grated and cut in half, and it really is beautiful. I do want to go back to the photos. You have just absolutely amazing vegetable photos in this book, along with all the great stories and everything. And I wondered, well, it can't be this, obviously not the same photographer. Somebody's darn good at picking photos, though.
Yeah, we have several photographers over the years. Right now, we mostly are using our photographer, one person right at the main. Laura is our main one right now, but it's been several people over the years. So usually, you know, anywhere from one to three photographers throughout the year. So.
Oh, man, they're beautiful photos. Dan in Madison, your turn. Hi, Dan.
Yeah, hi. How are you?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Yeah, thanks. I was calling to just get some input about grapes. You know, you mentioned a little bit earlier that a fruit's a fruit, a vegetable's a vegetable. But clearly with you know, grapes and wines, Wisconsin's not going to be growing a world-class Pinot Noir anytime soon. And I just wanted to get your input on that.
Grapes in the Midwest.
Yeah, grapes is something. Maybe you have the answer, but I'm really weak on grapes and fruiting. Besides seed-grown crops, I'm really weak on any kind of... orcharding or nursery stock. I'm pretty much a vegetable and small crop person, so I don't really have a good answer on that.
Okay. Dan, thank you for calling. Kathy in Appleton, it's your turn. Hi, Kathy.
Good morning. I have a question. I purchased some seeds for the tall snapdragons, and I planted them, and it said not to put any heat underneath and just to spray them. So I've been spraying them, and out of 48 cells with, you know, probably four or five seeds in each cell, only four or five have sprouted. So
that's not good.
I don't know if I'm doing something wrong or if I just got, can you get bad seed?
How long has it been?
It's been probably at least 3 weeks to a month.
Yeah, that's way too long. How warm is it where you're keeping them?
It's in a south-facing window.
And so it'd be like in the 70s or?
Yeah, probably not that warm at night, though.
So that could be affecting it if it's too cool, but it shouldn't. That should be warm enough. Yeah, it's hard to say. Did you purchase the seeds through us, or?
I don't remember where I got them.
Okay. Yeah, if you purchase them through us, we'd be glad to, you know, send you a replacement on it. And most other companies will too. If you got it wherever you got it, you might just try a replacement. Sometimes the first batch doesn't work, and also as it's getting warmer, they'll probably be warmer by the window as well. So you might start with fresh soil though, and not replant in the same containers, because if there's any like viruses or bacteria or fungi that in there, that sometimes if there's something in the soil, it can also cause the seeds to rot. So you might want to start with some fresh soil and not use whatever soil. If it's been in the pot for a month, the soil might be getting a little old, and it, you know, but other than that, I don't know what to tell you. The other option is to, you know, start the seed outside once it warms up, but then you're, you know, late for your flowers.
But there'd still be plenty of time to get going on a new batch.
Correct. Yeah, you can still start inside and still start outside. But, you know, the longer you wait, of course, the longer it is till you get flowers.
Yeah, there you go, Kathy. Thank you.
You should have about 90% germination on those, 80 to 90% typically. But, you know, it varies so much depending on, you know, so many different variables.
I'm Larry Mueller. Jer Gettle, our guest today from Baker Creek Heirlooms. And you are listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. taking a look at heirloom seeds and talking vegetables in general with our guest today, Jer Gettle, owner of Baker Creek Heirloom Seed Company. It's great to have him with us once again. I think it's kind of perfect. And Joe in Rhinelander has something for us, Jer, so let's go there. Joe, thank you for calling.
Yeah, good morning. Just a question about a seed starting mix. I'm always starting seeds, and it's just kind of fun to make my own mix. Have you got an opinion about that?
Unfortunately, I don't know of a good mix that that you can, you know, something you can use locally. The things that work the best, as far as I'm concerned, or know of anyway, is either coconut core, which supposedly is more sustainable, or, you know, a peat moss, of course, for your base. The challenges with actually using soil for starting seeds, it works okay for growing seeds, as long as they're not in too small of a pot where it gets, that's the challenge, you know, with too small of a pot and soil. It gets heavy. And then also the seeds inside where the sun isn't hitting it directly and the ultraviolet rays aren't killing the diseases and funguses and so forth in the soil, it tends to make the seeds rot. So, you know, starting out with, you know, peat moss or coconut core or something like that, and then adding, you know, various amendments to that. But I don't really have, we don't usually make our own mix. We have in the past, but we haven't really did a whole lot recently to make our own mix. We've tried a couple times, but if you're doing it outdoors for your pots for later on, you know, it can be a mix of like peat moss or coconut core or even straw and dirt will work for a while, you know, but indoors and in small pots, it's more difficult.
Thank you very much for calling, Joe. Appreciate it. Let's turn to Gary in Madison next. Hi, Gary.
Hello. Yeah, I've got a question about growing tomatoes in the hay bale. I tried it for the first time last year with one plant, and right from the get-go, it just did not work well. I bought a bale of hay, and I couldn't, like, dig a hole into the hay because of it so tightly compacted. It was very hard to accomplish that part of it. And then as I just did it throughout the year, the plant just did not do well. It just really didn't produce hardly anything. And I'm just wondering, any tips on, you know, growing tomatoes in a bale of hay?
Did you?
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, did you treat the bale in the proper fashion, kind of follow the rules for treating the bale before you?
I didn't do anything to the bale.
Oh, okay. Well, there's your trouble. You need, there's about a 10-day period or 12-day period where you need to set the bale, have the bale up on its, you know, the prickly end, so that's on top, and then you water that bale. And I don't want to give you the exact instructions, but I think you're watering it every day. And there's some fertilizer that you put in the beginning. And that's to get the bale to start to decompose.
Ah.
And as it decomposes, then it's producing its own fertilizer, essentially.
Right.
And then I found it when I've straw baled garden, I find it very easy once the bale is conditioned to get the plant in and to keep it going. I actually had very good luck with my straw bales. There's a book out and a lot of information. If you type in straw bale gardening,
okay,
there's a really nice book out on it. And also quite a bit of instruction online, but the whole process of seasoning the bale or bales is critical.
Gotcha. Oh, that was the problem.
Okay.
When should I start that? In April or?
Well, you'd start it. You want to time it about the time that you are going to be putting your tomato, that you want your tomato plants in the ground. So you would start seasoning the plant maybe, see, you're in Madison, so you might start seasoning the plant in earlier May.
But you said seasoning the plant.
Seasoning the bale, excuse me.
Okay, in May.
Yeah, probably maybe the second week of May you could start in on that, and if you're in the Madison area, and a couple of weeks of that, then you're getting close to the time that hopefully your tomato plants are then ready to put in.
Perfect.
And you put the plant in, and then you need to, most people overwater once they get the tomato plant in, and what that the result of that is that it flushes out the good organic matter that's being developed. So you need to water, but again, there are some rules and so forth on that as well.
Right, yeah. And then I actually took the bale, and then after it's all decomposed, I threw it all over in my garden.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody told me that was a bad thing to do because now I'm going to get all kinds of weeds in the garden.
Well, did you use straw or did you use hay?
Straw.
Depends on the straw. Some bales, you know, it depends on where the bales were harvested.
Yeah.
If they were harvested in an area where there were a lot of weeds in that field,
mm-hmm.
You may wind up with more weeds than you want.
Oh, great.
But it's good. I wouldn't worry. You know, wait and see what happens. Did you have a lot of weeds coming out of the bale as it was growing through the summer?
No, actually none.
Okay, well, then you probably got a bale that didn't have a lot of weed seeds in it, so you may be just fine.
Okay. Well, great. That's very helpful. Thanks. I'm going to try it again.
Okay, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. I jumped in there, Jer, because I've had a lot of experience with straw bales. I hope
well,
I
that's
didn't...
amazing. No, that's a perfect because we've only had very light use. So, it's something we don't do a whole lot. We've played around with it, but we don't have any real knowledge.
Jim in Watertown, we'll go to you next. Hi, Jim.
Hello, how you doing?
Good.
Thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
Hey, so I haven't gardened in forever, you know. But they've rent a few plots out here, and I've been thinking about it the last couple of years of renting a plot and starting a garden. Well, in saying that, really can't beat the taste of, say, a heirloom tomato. So I was wondering, do you get the taste from the soil, or do you get the taste from the plant itself? And is there a happy medium that I need to look to do to make the seeds grow better, you know, so that I'm about the flavor right now. I'll work on making sure they grow by reading.
Yeah, it's both. But if you don't have a good variety, if you have a variety that tastes like a store-bought tomato, even if you grow it in really rich soil, it's still going to taste bad. So you need decently rich soil. It doesn't have to be perfect, but as long as you have decently rich soil and a good variety, you should have great flavor. And that depends on what you like. You know, myself, I tend to like tomatoes that have some of the green colors in them. They have a deeper, richer, sweeter taste. Other people like, you know, really mild, bland tomatoes that are just sweet. I like the ones that are both sweet, really sweet with just a bit of tart. And then other people like more of the tart tomatoes like Rutgers or, you know, something that's more. And for canning, a lot of times people like the more it's just tart. And so it kind of depends on the variety you're looking for. If you're looking for really sweet tomatoes, generally the lighter colors, and then the reds and the, you know, the greens and the purples tend to have more of a deep, complex flavors. And each one's different, though. That's the thing with the different colors. Each one will be just like oranges taste different than, you know, grapefruits. A lot of it's due to the color, and the color represents the different antioxidants and minerals in the fruit. So go with a variety that has a rich flavor, and then, you know, make sure your soil is at least decently good, and you should have great tomatoes.
Yeah. I keep thinking about Brad's Atomic Grape Tomato. as a tomato that have you ever found anybody that didn't like those?
There is quite a few people that don't like them. For one thing, they tend to be more sweet than tart. So some people just don't like the really sweet taste. They want more of a tart, acidic tasting tomato. So there is quite a few people that don't like that taste. But, you know, it is our most popular overall tomato. But every tomato has its fans. And then the people that just, you know, some people just, they only want a yellow tomato or a red tomato, too. You have those that are, you know, only grow one color. But in general, most, you know, 90% of the people love it, I would say, and 10% of the people, you know, don't like the taste. But that's the way it is about almost every tomato. It's hard to find everybody to agree on a tomato simply because I think there's so many variations and so many varieties and so many people that are kind of passionate about one that they know of in their area or in their family.
Jim, does that help out? Oh, we may have lost Jim there. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Pat in Wauwatosa wonders about chlorine in tap water. May that stop seeds from sprouting?
We don't have chlorine in our water here in where we're at currently, but our general manager has it in town, and most of many of our customers, I don't know if most, but probably more than half of our customers use city water, and so it's I don't think it causes seeds to not sprout, and unless the concentrations would be super high, but as far as normal drinking water, I've never heard of it causing them not to sprout. And they typically grow fairly well as long as the chlorine, burns off, fairly quick. And generally, it burns off fairly quick. It's always better, of course, to, use well water or rainwater if you have the choice. But many people don't have the choice. You can also put a filter on there. Some people put a filter on there if your chlorine is really strong in your area.
Yeah, I've thinking about the seeds that I start and have started, and I've often had chlorine water, and I've never had any trouble, so I don't think, as you say, I suppose if you had a really strong chlorine, but typically that is in drinking water is not all that strong. So it should be just fine. Appreciate that question, though. And you sell live plants, by the way, as well, do you not?
We do a limited number of live plants on our website, and this year we're not pre-ordering them, which means people just have to check week by week. Every week we will have some, and we'll have some different ones every week. So right now I don't know how many's left. We just started shipping again on our website. So each week we will have a new batch, probably every Wednesday. So check every Wednesday, and there'll be new varieties available. And every week we'll probably have anywhere from 20 to 30, 40 varieties.
So lots of varieties there, maybe from, and shipping has got to be an issue. Or you got a good way to ship?
So far, shipping is going fine, and we're offering free shipping, actually, on everything this year. So.
Oh, man, that's a good deal. You can't beat that. Jared Gettle, our guest today from the Baker Creek Seed Company. It's great to have him with us here on the Ideas Network to talk about growing heirloom seeds. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. We're taking a look at heirloom seeds on the Garden Talk program today. Larry Mueller here. We've been answering a number of questions relating to vegetables in general with our guest, Jer Gettle, founder of Bear Creek Heirloom Seeds. They offer nearly 2,000 varieties of vegetables, flowers, and herbs. It's the largest selection of heirloom varieties in the U.S. So what varieties of heirlooms do you like to grow or eat? And let's take another call. Jan in Viroqua, it's your turn. Hi, Jan.
Hi, guys. A friend of mine gave me a couple of bags of poultry poo when she moved out of town, and she said it was good, very good on berry bushes. They liked it. But I'm wondering if it is also suitable for vegetables. I'm more used to using a tamer nitrogen by using alfalfa meal, but I'd like your recommendations on whether or not to use it on vegetables and how to judge how much to put on.
Well, anyway, here at Baker Creek, I don't know what you do, but here at Baker Creek, we use a lot of it in our gardens, and we just basically, what we do is we purchase like a truckload of usually turkey manure in the fall before the planting season, sometimes even a year in advance, but at least in the fall ahead of time, we just let it sit out over the winter. And by spring, it's still pretty strong, but we spread it out as soon as we can, you know, usually in April. And after it sat for at least, you know, 5-6 months at the minimum, and spread it on the garden. And we usually spread, you know, we don't do it every year, but probably every other year. And we'll spread like an inch or so of it on over the garden and then till it in. And we haven't had any burning or anything with that. We'll also oftentimes mix in compost and straw and other things as well, you know, a few inches of that if we can. But usually an inch a year on our garden is what we usually, you know, about up to an inch a year probably.
So, and yours, Jan, it's dry and already kind of composted out?
Well, it's at least 2 years old, but it's been in the bag, in a plastic bag.
Yeah.
I would think you'd be fine with putting some on. You just don't go too heavy. But generally, you know, depending on how much space you're using it, you probably won't overdo it. But, you know, just kind of be careful at first. But, We haven't had any problems. We've even had areas where we put it on like 2 inches thick and we haven't, you know, burned, but it could happen. But, you know, just start out with a light amount and see how it does.
Right. I'm astounded because I was thinking you'd say like a cup for 5 square feet or something like that. Okay.
Yeah, I don't think you're going to burn as long as you don't plant directly in it, you know, mix it into the soil a bit. And as long as the little seedlings aren't coming up right through it, that would be your only danger.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks so much for calling. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call or email at ideas@WPR.org. Connie was looking for suggestions for a sweet and easy-to-grow carrot.
Oh, there's a bunch of those. If you're looking for an orange carrot, our favorite is the new Kuroda carrot. It's a Japanese variety. It's actually not new. It was new when it was introduced, but it's actually an old variety, probably at least 60 years old from Japan. But it makes a really short, probably about six inches long. And it's a fairly thick carrot, really sweet, really crispy, just our best overall orange carrot. And then For winter garden, fall gardening, for fall and into the winter, our favorite carrot is the Atomic Red's good as well, but our overall favorite is the Kyoto Red. That's our favorite all-time carrot, but it has to be growing from like late summer, early fall into the winter, and you harvest it once it starts getting really cold and frosty, and the carrots are just super sweet. That's probably our sweetest all-time carrot, but it has to be only growing in the fall and into the winter. So those are our two favorites. They're both Japanese varieties, and they're both incredibly, you know, fine flavored.
So the second one you mentioned, the fall one, was Kyoto Red, but I didn't
get Kyoto Red.
Yeah, the first one again was, what was the first one?
New Kuroda. New Kuroda.
How is Kuroda? Is
K-U-R-O-D-A.
K-U-R-O-D-A.
And it's just kind of the classic Japanese heirloom carrot. It was, you know, it was developed from the regular Kuroda, I guess, and that's why they put the word new on it. It was a selection of the Kuroda, but it's a historic variety as well. There's several selections of the Kuroda carrot. I mean, probably dozens of selections, but, and it's, you know, fairly common here in the U.S. as well. It's not super rare, but it's still the best, I think, best carrot you can grow for at least a home gardener.
What are some good ones to try with your kids? You know, have you got some kids you want to put them in the vegetable garden and learning and working in there a little bit? What do you recommend?
It kind of depends on what they like. Of course, radishes are really quick, so that's a fun one to get their interest. But not all kids like radishes. Other things that kids usually like, though, and grow fairly quick are cucumbers, sweet corn, also the brightly colored ornamental corns. The popcorns are always great for kids. Kids love especially the ornamental popcorns going in. Open the different colors and shapes and sizes. But it just depends on what they like. You know, some kids want to grow watermelon or some kids just want to grow flowers. So just find out what they enjoy and try a variety of colors and, you know, types or flavors. Kids love the, you know, the variety, I think, the colors. And they also love to be able to harvest their own crops.
You know, the one that that caught my eye was that was different was strawberry spinach. Explain how that looks and tastes. It's quite an interesting
look. It's a really unique plant. It's originally, I believe, from North America. There might be some debate on that. It was rediscovered in a monastery garden in Europe, but I don't really know where it originated. It's supposedly in North America, but it's also, you know, grows wild in other places as well. But it's a relative of spinach. It's not a true spinach. The plant looks very similar to spinach in a lot of ways, but it also produces long seed flower spikes that produce bright red fruit. And a lot of people say they're totally, you know, bland and don't have any flavor. The key is picking them when they're all the way ripe. A lot of people, they will turn red, you know, and people think, okay, they're ready to eat, and they will eat them and they will basically taste like spinach, the berries. But you got to wait until they start getting very soft. And then they have a wonderful watermelon, strawberry taste once they're really ripe. But if you pick them when they're green, even though they're red on the outside, you got to wait till they're all the way soft. Because if they're not soft, even though they're red, they're not ripe. But once you get them soft, they're just delicious. They're great. They're make amazing for salads, especially when they're ripe. You can use them when they're green in salads too, but they're a great replacement for people that like add raspberries to salads or make raspberry vinaigrette. Perfect for salads, but people also make jellies and pies and also great in fruit salads, or I just like to eat them off the plant once they're really all the way ripe. And the leaves are also edible, like a spinach, maybe not quite as high quality as spinach, but it's a great substitute for spinach.
And you know, they're good for you too, aren't they?
They are. Yeah, in moderation. It's one that if you eat too much, some people can have some allergic reactions like stomach upset if you eat too much, but it's not normal for the normal amounts. It's healthy as long as you don't try to eat pounds of them or something like that. But it's, for normal amounts, it's kind of like a lot of other fruits and vegetables. For normal amounts, they're healthy, they're nutritious, and they're really high in fiber.
And I guess that goes pretty much anything. If you eat too much,
yeah, right. Seedy fibrous crops, if you eat too much of them, you might have some issues later on. But as far as normal amounts, you don't notice the difference. They're perfect for normal amounts.
Relating to that, I believe, is Ellen. We'll get to Ellen in a minute. But Barbara in Pewaukee has something for us. Barbara, hi.
Hello. Hello. Nice to be on.
Well, thanks for joining us. What have you got for us?
Well, I have a recipe for watermelon pickles that uses the rind for watermelon. And for years now, I can't use it because the rinds are so thin. You know, they're hybrid. They're all less rind and more melon. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if there is a heirloom seed that I could use that would have the rinds that I could get 20 years ago.
What was that question one more time? I had a little hard time hearing you.
Are there seeds that I can get that will give me a decent rind that I can use for watermelon pickles?
Okay, sure. I got it clear now. There is several out there. The older varieties, I'm trying to remember which one. We had one that we marked the thickest one last year. I'm trying to remember which one it was now. I've lost track of it. I know the like the Cobb Gem watermelon has a pretty thick rind. A lot of the really older varieties, Black Diamond's another one with a pretty thick rind. Black Diamond would be a choice. And there was another one, but it slipped my mind right now. We wrote it down somewhere. But Black Diamond would be a good choice for a thicker rind for a watermelon. A lot of the older varieties with thicker skins tend to make a bigger rind. The little icebox sized watermelons, most of them tend to have really small thin rinds too, like our like the Cahoe and Sugar Baby, and a lot of the smaller varieties also have smaller, thinner rinds, so you don't tend to get much rind out of them. So I'd recommend probably like a Black Diamond or something like that.
Barbara, does that help?
Yeah. Am I able to get it through his organization? Or
You can get Black Diamond through us, or you can probably even find it at your local nursery on the seed rack, or maybe even the dollar store. I don't know. Sometimes that Black Diamond is one that it's spotty. You might be able to find it locally or not, but it's fairly commonly available.
But you have it available at...
We do, yes.
And so where does she go for that?
You can go to rareseeds.com, and the shipping is free. Even if you just make an order for $2.75, it's still free shipping we're offering this year. So you can get it on our website if you can't find it locally, for sure. So,
all right. Thank you again for calling. Let's turn to Ellen in Waupun. Hi, Ellen.
Hi, Larry and guests. Thank you so much for your program. It's my favorite part of the week every week. I just wanted to comment on the strawberry spinach. I've grown it in the past, and I liked it, but you better have a dedicated bed for it, because you will be growing strawberry spinach the rest of your life. I have a really hard time taming it down, and so that's my recommendation.
Good point. Yeah, we have not had an issue with it so far, but everybody has different things that... I think we pulled all ours out actually before we ate the berries for a while, and then we pulled the plant out to plant something else in the bed. So I don't think a lot of seeds fell to the ground actually. So I think that's probably where we didn't have a problem.
There we go. Ellen, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You know, as I have your catalog in front of me, which is always so much fun, and I've got to pay attention to my callers and to you, but I'm always looking through the catalog. And there's one page 379. I just opened up to that page by chance, and it says, have you tried the toothache plant?
Yeah, that's a fun one. I've actually used that before. I had it was the weekend, and I had a bad toothache, and I ended up getting a root canal in it. But anyway, it was the weekend, and I was like, what do I do? The dentists are all closed. The ibuprofen just isn't cutting it. I can't get anything stronger, easily anyway, without going to the emergency room. So I put a couple toothache plant flowers in my mouth. I didn't figure it would hurt anything because they were growing out in front, right in front of our house. And I noticed, wow, the pains was just 98% gone. But my mouth was totally numb as well. But it totally numbs your mouth. And I went to the dentist the next week and I said, is there anything you've got that's I'm using right now? I just told him what I was doing and the toothache plant, and he asked how my pain level was, and he said, well, if it's working that good, I don't have anything any better. So I was wondering if he'd just give me a shot or something. But as long as I keep that toothache plant, every couple times a night I would have to trade it out, and then I'd go right back to sleep. I was able to sleep and everything with it, which I didn't think I was going to sleep all weekend. So it definitely it's not approved as a, toothache cure, but it doesn't cure anything for that matter. But it definitely numbs your mouth. That's scientifically proven to numb your mouth for better or for worse. You won't taste or feel anything else for a while.
And it's an herb, right?
It is. Yeah, it's a little flowering herb. They actually use it some. They're experimenting like using it in the beverage industry to add a really light, spicy kick. If you use it in very light moderation and things, it adds a little bit of a prickly, kind of almost a little bit of electric shock-like feel. It's kind of like, it's hard to describe, kind of like carbonated water, but different, It's kind of that tingly feel like you would get from carbonation, but totally different than that, too. It's its own sensation.
Oh, man. Well, it's always a surprise when I open up the, you know, no matter where I open your catalog up, I'm seeing something. I think, man, what's the story behind that? And then typically you have the story behind something like walking stick kale, for example.
Yeah, there's so many stories out there, and there's so much more to document. It's every week something falls into our lap, though, and it's like, wow, just this last week we, you know, discovered a new seed we'd been looking for all the last 6 months, desperately searching for Chinese wool flower. It's a celosia actually. It makes a flower head that looks like a ball of wool or ball of yarn. And we'd been looking everywhere for it, and it totally disappeared. And finally, a customer friend found it for us in Japan when he was over there. So, you know, it's just, you never know where things are going to, you know, show up. And it's just a continual thing for, you know, in this industry, though. Old gardeners or young gardeners will say, here's something from my grandmother. And it'll be sometimes, you know, totally something that's totally amazing.
Oh, well, that walking stick kale, the photo of that, I mean, it gets 12 feet tall, a kale plant.
Yeah, it's pretty fun. I remember seeing that in seed catalogs, when, you know, as a child, and it's kind of almost disappeared out of a lot of seed catalogs. At one time, it was, you know, offered by a lot of seed catalogs, and I didn't want to see it disappear out of this country's catalogs entirely. Anyway, there's almost maybe one other supplier right now offering it, so it's pretty. I was getting to feel it was pretty endangered. So,
Stephen Appleton, your turn now. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Afternoon, I guess. So I just got a question about a good tomato, probably red, more quantity, either heirloom or organic, if you would have some.
A red tomato that produces a good quantity, is that correct?
Yes.
Yes.
There's several really good ones. Our overall favorite for just a good productive, if you're looking for something that's canning, that will also, it's not huge. It isn't like a huge slicer, but it's a good medium size. Is the raspberry Liana tomato. It's actually more of a raspberry color. It's not a true orange red. It's more of a, varies more like pink red, but it looks red, but it's more of a raspberry color. It's raspberry Liana, and it's on our website, but it's our favorite probably for just a super productive. And it's also has been pretty disease resistant for us here anyway. It's been and the years when we have a lot of disease, it tends to just keep producing. But that's been one of our favorites. But there's a lot of good tomatoes, you know, for Rebecca Allen's another really good for a little bigger one. Rebecca Allen's a really good for that medium, large, more like a small, medium size beefsteak. It's a very large tomato, but, you know, more like probably 1 pound fruit.
Steve, does that help?
That helps a lot. Yep.
Right. Those two varieties, you can't really go wrong with them. They grow pretty much everywhere, too. I mean, they do in most conditions. So.
You mentioned... Jer, that, you know, you had a friend or somebody that you'd worked with found you some seeds in Japan, and you have you do have sort of a core of people, if I'm not mistaken, that have provided you with seeds over the years.
We do. We work with both our employees as they travel, or, you know, even just on the internet, of course, and, you know, people that come in contact with us, but then also people that are friends, people that are acquaintances, people that found out about us in another country or another region, and they say, hey, I'm in Iraq, and, you know, here's what's happened to our seed supply. Can you help us save our, you know, my family's seeds or whatever? So it's a whole host of different ways we get seeds, and that's what really makes it fun. And then, you know, the stories we hear, you know, on a almost daily basis, it's always, always exciting and fun to hear people's personal stories as well.
You've been, you know, the farm has come up as a topic of conversation. Tell us about your farm in Missouri.
Our farm here in Missouri is basically a collection of buildings, warehouses, the seed store. We have also some outbuildings, like a little blacksmith shop and animal shelters and so forth. But we also have all our gardens here, and we have about 10 different greenhouses where we grow stuff. When we're not growing stuff in the summer, of course, we can grow stuff in the greenhouses year-round. So we're always producing crops year-round in the greenhouses. And then outside, we have about 20 different smaller gardens for both seed production and also just for testing stuff, checking out new things, trialing things. And, of course, you know, growing lots of stuff to eat and have fun with.
Yeah, and you've got some good tasters there, kids and so forth, that are maybe your own kids, too, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, yeah, our kids love, you know, it's always fun to be able to. We just actually it's just winding down now, but we are growing a lot of citrus in the greenhouse. We have about 40 younger trees, but I think we just harvested about our 600th orange for the year. They're similar to what's sold as Sumo orange in the grocery store is what we have in the greenhouses. And we were surprised over just a year, you know, we already are getting a good crop. We had all the oranges we could eat for about 3 months or so, 3-4 months. So.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Jer, for being with us today. It's been a lot of fun, as always. I hope we have a chance to visit again. Thanks. Jer Gettle is the owner of Baker Creek Heirloom Seed Company. And just go to his website. The website is rareseeds.com, rareseeds.com. He's a fun guy, really passionate about vegetables and seeds, especially heirlooms. So great to have him with us. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network.